I am absolutely filled to the bursting point with pride in this church this morning, despite the fact that we are struggling to meet our operating budget, and despite the fact that 1992 may be our toughest single year with debt service as we wait for the building pledges to come in. Despite those concerns, on Christmas Eve, the compassionate and generous members and friends of this church contributed $4,500 to the work of the Wichita Children's Home. For their staff and for all the abused and neglected children who will benefit from your help, thank you. For the past 5 weeks, except for a Christmas interlude, we have been getting ready for that moment in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians when Paul passes love, agape love, the New Testament kind, through the prism of his own intellect and breaks it down into its several colors. I hope the first color does not seem disappointingly pale to you. Paul starts by saying, "This love of which I speak is slow to lose patience." Patience, I have to admit, is not a very exciting virtue. It smells like routine to most of us, a willingness to put up with things, what someone once called the Cinderella trait, because it seems to sit at home among the ashes, while the glamorous sisters like courage and energy and daring trip off to the ball gorgeously dressed. If we can't say anything else about a person, we fall back on a pale compliment like, "Well, at least he's patient." And what we really mean much of the time is that he's plodding, unexciting, dull. So I think the first thing we have to do is excuse Paul from meaning anything even remotely like that. He isn't talking about laziness or fear or indifference, all of which some people call patience because they don't want to give those rather shabby traits their real name. You and I all know people who seem to be patient because they are too lazy to be impatient, people so indifferent that they really don't care about anything, so that when they see one of us all hot and bothered, they simply yawn and say, "Why don't you be patient like me?" Ambrose Bierce, that very strange American writer, once called this kind of patience a minor form of despair disguised as a virtue. And then there are people too cowardly to condemn cruelty or injustice, but who prefer to call their fear by the name of patience. I assure you that living like a slug is not what Paul had in mind when he said that the first characteristic of agape love is knowing how to be patient. So what did he mean? Something like this, I think, that love can afford not to be in a hurry, that it can wait calmly, ready to do its work when the moment comes. It's the quality in love that makes it last, that gives it staying power. Most of us, I assume from what I see in myself, have an uneven track record when it comes to this particular item of character. We manage to be patient sometimes, but then we get caught in a down moment and defeat ourselves in something that really matters. Thomas Carlyle wrote once in a letter, "I have a natural talent for being in a hurry, which is a very bad talent." Do some of you blush with me when you hear that? It's hard for people in a hurry to be patient. Since we are supposed to confess our faults one to another according to the Bible and pray one for another that we may do better, let's take a moment to consider how we do, each one of us, in this matter of being patient. I don't know whether it works this way for you, but I find myself better able to be patient about big and important things than about the silly and trivial ones that plague life. As somebody put it, I can stand being swallowed by a whale better than I can being nibbled to death by minnows. For example, I spend a lot of time driving, much of it in heavy traffic, and I'm not always patient with drivers who are still daydreaming when the light changes to green, who poke and piddle with a long line of traffic behind them. I sometimes talk to these drivers, and Billy has thought once or twice that my words were not sufficiently tender. I sometimes forget that clerks may not really intend to waste so much time with bureaucratic nonsense, and that telephone solicitors who invariably call at mealtime are more likely to be victims of a scheme than the creators of it. And am I wonder sometimes, the only person who loses patience with whatever faceless individual wrote the directions for assembling the lawnmower, the barbecue grill, the toy that looked so easy when we saw it on the shelf? These are the times when we say what has been called the prayer of the modern American, which goes, "Dear God, I pray for patience, and I want it right now." One true thing about this simple, homely virtue called patience is that we have abundant opportunities in life to develop it. Unlike Socrates, perhaps, who puzzled his friends when he married an absolute bear of a woman, and who told those friends with a smile when they asked him why on earth he had married Xantippe, that he had always wanted to learn patience and that now he had the best chance of his life. He might have learned it more easily if he had lived in a society as complex and as frequently mixed up as ours. I read last week about a couple who thought they had a great idea for their children's special Christmas gift. They ordered a kit for a treehouse from a mail order catalog, but on Christmas Eve, as they began to put the pieces together, they noticed, to their dismay, that while they had received the plans for a treehouse, they had been sent the materials for a sailboat. When they wrote a rather impatient letter of complaint to the company, they got back this apology: "While we regret the inconvenience this mistake must have caused you, we would point out that it is nothing compared to that of the man who is out on a lake somewhere trying to sail your treehouse." Sometimes we're impatient because we have unreasonable expectations. We want things that are impossible, and when we don't get them, we unravel and make everybody's life impossible. Parents are sometimes guilty. Teachers have to learn better than that quickly or perish. I learned a lot of things about the patience of teachers by hearing my wife and her elementary and secondary school colleagues talk. I found out that there are several reasons why I could not teach grade school children, but I know the first one. I'm not patient enough. I marvel at people who can gear down to the pace of children and hear them out patiently hour after hour. It takes a special talent, and it's part of what it means to love people. But imagine something like this happening to you. We're in the time of year when problems with overshoes keep popping up in school, and I see teachers nodding their heads all over the room, especially in kindergarten. In one of them the other day, the teacher tugged and pulled to get a pair of overshoes on a little boy who finally said to her, "They don't fit too well because they're not mine." Without strangling him, the teacher patiently pulled and tugged some more and got them off, only to have the boy add, "They're my sister's, but my mother lets me wear them." And there was that little girl. Current humor would have her be a blonde, I suppose, who cried at the end of the school day because there was only one pair of galoshes left in the cloakroom and they were not hers. The teacher looked in every corner and under all the desks and finally gave up, unable to find any other galoshes. Hanging on to a little tender patience with all her might, she said, "How do you know that these aren't yours?" "Because," the little girl sniffled, "mine had snow on them." Love requires patience. And Carlyle, whom I quoted earlier, said another memorable thing on this topic. It's easier to love people when they exist only on paper than to love Jack and Kit who stand there in the body, hungry, untoward, jostling you, barring you with angular elbows and a stupid will of their own. And how right he was. It's not hard to love people in our minds, where they can be abstracted and idealized, but real people have wills of their own. They forget to smile gratefully when you take them the Christmas presents, or they refuse to wash their feet or chew breath mints. And if love is not patient, then it's out of business quickly. In a course I taught many times, my students had to read the works of a 19th century poet and would-be reformer named Shelley, a man who sincerely wanted to do something for the wretched poor. He was sincere enough about it to leave his comfortable home and go to live in an Irish slum. But it didn't last long. He had not even imagined how dirty people would be, how they would smell, and how ungrateful they would be for what he was doing. So he went back home to write about loving them from a safe distance. So patience has 100 faces. But I suppose my favorite definition of the kind Paul had in mind would be creative waiting. The ability to live and hope that what you want for will eventually come if you create the right climate for it. Pearl Buck has a short story that illustrates something of what I mean. It's about a man and his wife who had a long-standing quarrel because he so desperately yearned to see the ocean and she so firmly thought that the idea was ridiculous. One morning as he was leaving for work, he came back into the house. She asked what was wrong, and he said that he thought he would finally take that bus trip to the sea, just go ahead and miss one day of work. It was an old argument in that house, and she knew all the rules. Why do you want to see a lot of water rolling in and out? I can't imagine why you feel you have to do that. Now you go ahead, you'll be late to work. So in the story, he went on to work. And as Miss Buck contrives her plot, an hour later he had a heart attack and died before the ambulance reached the hospital. His wife sat through the funeral in a daze, unable to realize that this man she loved, this man who had been with her through her entire adult life, this man who was actually more important to her than any other human being in the world, was dead. As the days passed, an idea began to haunt her. He would never see the ocean. She remembered the silly quarrels and the nights when he would bring home books about the sea and study them with an intensity and joy that actually made her jealous. But it's hard to admit a mistake, and even now she found herself saying, but it really would have been a waste of time and money, and it wouldn't have been all that great. Still, she kept remembering that they had lived only 200 miles away from the ocean all their married life. So finally she decided to go see the ocean herself, to discover what it was that had given him something to dream on when life got stale. She made the trip, and to her surprise, found the ocean beautiful beyond words. Beautiful, she thought, beyond what even her husband could have imagined. And she sat down on a beach alone and quietly confessed, I was wrong. He should have seen it. So why didn't he? The reader asks. After all, he was a grown man and he lived only 4 or 5 hours away. Did he simply prefer the dream of going to the reality of it? And then suddenly the story makes itself understood. His dream was not just to see the ocean, but to see it with this woman he loved. But how could that be? She thought it was all silly. If he had insisted, we're going whether you like it or not, her own wounded pride would have destroyed his dream. She would have said when they got there, now look, are you satisfied? There's all your damned water. Now we can go back home. So he could not press. He had to be patient. She had to want to be there with him. And finally, she was. And she felt his presence there as she felt it nowhere else. She made a resolution never to look at his grave again. If she were lonely, she would come to the sea. She knew very little about religion or the idea of life beyond the grave, but silently she found herself praying that he knew the things she now understood, why he wanted to be in that place, how much he had wanted her to be there with him. The point of Pearl Buck's story is that the woman came to her experience in the only way it could ever mean anything to her, by her own choice. Her husband, even in death, had enriched her experience by giving her something he could not force. He gave her that gift because he loved her and because love's first name is patience. The art of hoping, the stamina to wait, the courage to trust that one's dream will come true. First of all, the apostle says in that great 13th chapter, the kind of love of which I speak is slow to lose patience. You may wish to remember.